Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Gaining Perspective. I'm Andrew Ruckelman, your host here on the Life Coach Radio Network of Blog Talk Radio. And today's episode is Addiction, Disputing the Myths and Presenting the Facts. My guest today is Rich Dowling, the founder and owner of the Thought Exchange Center for Personal Achievement. And Rich offers, through the thought exchange process, for creating a happier, healthier, and more satisfying lifestyle. He personally has gained independence from alcohol, nicotine, and caffeine, earned his master's degree in counseling, is married, and founded a successful counseling practice. His credentials include a licensed professional counselor, a master addictions counselor, and an associate fellow of the Albert Ellis Institute. He also specializes in assisting individuals with their desire to enhance their emotions and behavior by learning to take control of the one thing humans have most control of, their thinking. He is especially interested in letting individuals who did not find the 12-step disease model helpful know that there are professional treatments and self-help options available for gaining independence from drugs, including alcohol, nicotine, and other problematic behaviors such as compulsive gambling, eating, and other disorders. Just a little bit more about Rich, as he serves as a founding member of the director for the Smart Recovery, which is Self-Management and Recovery Training Self-Help Network. Rich is an adjunct instructor at Montclair University teaching interpersonal relations, social psychology, child abuse and neglect, and general psychology. So he's got a lot of information and a lot of backing behind this, and as we tackle this tough, sensitive topic, it is great for me to have someone like him on the show today. So some of the things we're going to cover is, what is addiction and how are the ways of treating it? What are the words, actions, and behaviors that those considered addicts have? How does society play into the role of defining what is an addict and how people treat them? And sometimes I want you to think just to be open to other possibilities of what's out there. And I know as a sensitive topic such as addiction, people have either a hard time listening to what it is or don't want to believe in it. So I thought that this would be a very important topic as I talk about gaining perspective, really wanting to allow people to be open to other options and other thoughts of what they have for themselves. So with that, I'd like to say welcome aboard, Rich, and are you ready to get started?
I'm all set. Thank you, Andrea. I'm very happy to be here.
Excellent. Thank you. This is going to be a great hour that we're going to have, and I bet it goes by really fast. If you're listening and want to give us a call as you're listening to us talk about the various aspects of addiction, please give us a call at 646-716-9397 to talk to Rich directly. And if you'd rather stay anonymous, feel free to give us a tweet at Coach Host Radio using hashtag Gaining Perspective, and we'll try to get it on the air for you. So let's kick it off with the most interesting aspect of it. Is it a disease? You were talking about the myths of it. Is addiction, based on your experience, a true disease?
Well, as far as I understand it, it doesn't meet the medical definition of a disease. But according to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, Substance Disorders, it's a maladaptive behavior. Whether someone is physically dependent or not, they still make a choice to use. Now, I know that in and of itself is quite controversial, and if there's any those listening, I can hear a collective gulp there when I say that. But let me clarify what I mean. Now, even if someone is genetically predisposed, that in and of itself does not constitute a disease. And I would encourage people, by all means, to check this out. Certainly don't take my word for anything. You decide. You check it out. But that's what I've come to understand based on my experience and research. But here's what I mean by a choice. People right away will say, well, I didn't wake up one morning and decide to become an addict or alcoholic. And I'll say, well, no, probably not. Although I did meet someone recently who did actually do that, but that's a whole other story. What people do is they do wake up one morning and somewhere during that day decide to use alcohol, other drugs, or engage in other, you know, thought-based behaviors. And then they decide to do it again and again and again, to the point where some do abuse and or become physically dependent. People stop also all the time. People gain their independence all the time. So how do they do that? Most do it on their own without formal intervention, professional treatment, or self-help. Now, again, that's very controversial because the addiction treatment field suggests that people must go through treatment. In fact, the predominant treatment is 12-step disease. Unfortunately, statistically, most people don't find it helpful for very practical reasons. Now, those who do find it helpful, that's wonderful. It makes up about 90% of treatment, and there are plenty of self-help groups around. So the model I use is an option to the 12-step disease, and it's particularly for those who do not find the 12 steps helpful for very practical reasons. So now, just to add a little bit more to this, the disease model is so controversial. Again, I encourage people to decide for themselves because ultimately that's what they're going to do. I'm not about to tell anyone what they should or shouldn't do or how they should think. So maybe we could leave it there for the moment, and then we can, you know, pick up on it. There's much more to say about it. So if you'd like to respond to that, Andrea, or clarify something, I'd be happy to do that.
Well, yes, because it really goes back to you got me caught up on something earlier when you first started talking about it's a choice. And, you know, when people say that I didn't just wake up one day and decide I want to be an addict, and when they become dependent, how is it a choice to become dependent on something? In life, you know, we're dependent on food to give us sustenance, so it's really not a choice to want to eat. You know, we're not going to be able to live without it. So when you look at it as a choice to put yourself in that role with substance abuse, how is it, do you see that it actually is a choice? Because that to me is kind of hard to comprehend.
Well, it's thought-based. People have to think about doing it. Now, the more some people do it, the more they come to rely on it in some cases based on their thinking about it. Not to say it's easy to, you know, change this, but what people do is they develop habits, numerous habits surrounding this particular issue. We are so habituated as humans, for better or for worse, and the use of alcohol or other drugs, people through their thinking make the choice to use. They use it. It's generally symptomatic of, say, emotional discomfort, anxiety, anger, depression, guilt, shame. And the model that I use is called a cognitive behavioral model, suggesting people generally feel and behave the way they think, generally. And the one thing we have most control over is our thinking. Therefore, we can change the way we feel and behave by understanding the thinking dynamic and recognizing the faultiness of some of the thinking that's creating distress or leading us to behave in ways that aren't in our best interest, and then exchanging it for a more reasonable way. And I would argue that people who do engage in this behavior and then decide that it's not in their best interest and do stop, they have to change their thinking. They may not be aware of exactly what's changing, but whatever model they choose, they're going to have to change their thinking. The model I use gets very specific and really helps people identify the specific beliefs that they hold that create the distress and or lead them to behave in these ways that aren't in their best interest. I mean, we can take this in all different directions, but again, people ultimately make a choice. Now, people who do become, say, physically dependent and they experience the discomfort of withdrawal, they learn, some learn real quick, that in order to alleviate that discomfort, at least temporarily, is to take another hit of the drug, whether it's alcohol or some other drug, or engage in particular behavior. You mentioned that we have to eat food. Well, yeah, but we have a choice in what we eat. That's key. We have to drink fluids in order to survive as well. We have a choice in what fluids we drink. Some people choose alcohol, for example. So if someone's physically dependent, they're experiencing the negative consequences of the withdrawal, it's not comfortable, they don't like it, so they learn, take another hit, relieves it for a moment, brings them up to feeling better, and then, you know, the brain becomes accustomed to a certain amount of the substance within a certain period of time, and you know, they can go through this process of withdrawal and taking the drug, or they can make a choice to abstain. And as they go through the withdrawal, they still have a choice to kind of accept it without acting on it. They don't have to take the drug. And many people do this. I mean, it's just simply a fact. And they come out the other end in much better condition, generally, as they withdraw from the substance. And again, depending on how they go about it. Most people, as I understand it, do it on their own. I did it, basically, on my own. I went to quit smoking programs is what I did, and hypnosis. And like I said, I gained my independence from not only alcohol, but nicotine and caffeine at the time, or coffee at the time as well. And this was almost 30 years ago. So, I mean, I know from my own personal experience that I did it. I've met numerous other people who have. I've read studies about it. Some people benefit from various forms of self-help or professional treatment and other resources that they might come across. So there's no exact science here. But that's, in my understanding, why it's ultimately a choice, even if someone is physically dependent on it. As difficult as it may be for some to get through it and get over it, they still make a choice.
Yeah, and it brings me to, as we're in talking about this choice and how you've done it, and, you know, you get into the choice of how it started occurring. The thing that really sticks out most to me, and I will caveat this with, I am not an addiction master addiction counselor or know much, but I want to just ask some of these questions for the person who is like me, who only knows what society talks about because of the ignorance of just hearing what is said out there and believing what is said right off the bat without doing any of our own research. In your experience, whether it be personally through your own journey that you went through or being a master addiction counselor, do you find that more often the dependency comes out of the desire to not feel emotionally, which then when trying to get out of the habit becomes the physical pain that you're now trying to heal?
Right. It can start with someone, say, wanting to change the way they feel. A lot of it, a lot of this type of behavior is the result of what certain people experience as parenting, okay? Parenting styles can really confuse a child, create some discomfort in them. And as a child, you really don't understand what's going on. You know, you feel uncomfortable, anxiety, maybe some anger, depression, and you're looking for relief. You also like to be accepted by others. That's human nature. And birds of a feather tend to flock together, so to speak. You're looking for relief. You're looking for some kind of acceptance, peer acceptance, for example. And you find people who are, let's say, I don't know, smoking cigarettes, drinking a little alcohol, maybe doing some pot, you know, whatever it might be. And you decide, you make a choice to use some of that. And then along the way, you kind of find, hey, this kind of helps. And then, you know, if you're with the group, like-minded group, you're being socially acceptable. It's kind of a combination of things. And, you know, different people kind of move toward different substances, for example, or different behaviors. On the other hand, not everybody who's experiencing distress goes that way. They find their way out of it in a more positive way. So again, there's no exact science here, but as I encourage people, check it out for yourself. Think about your own experiences. Do some research. But this is what is being shown. I've been at it now. I've been in business for almost 20 years. And like I said, I specialize in working with people who don't find a 12-step disease model helpful. And this is what I see over and over and over again. Let me just give you an idea of my sense of the addiction treatment field. It's a mix of myths and facts, distorting reality, making it more difficult for many who would like to gain independence from alcohol and other drugs, including nicotine and other thought-based behaviors. Not that people are doing it out of malice, certainly. It's a confusing issue, and humans have a way of making things more confused than they have to be. For example, let's go back to, so people get started on this. Some, you know, use until they become, say, physically dependent, and then they deal with the withdrawal. That's uncomfortable. So they keep using it to help them deal with the withdrawal. Meanwhile, they're probably experiencing some emotional distress. They're compounding that, and it could become quite a mix, and they may not really understand exactly what's happening. So just to give you an idea, addiction defined, behavior that is compulsive in nature leading to negative consequences. The DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, suggest a diagnosis of abuse or dependence. Now, I believe that might have changed with the DSM-5 that's recently come out, which I haven't gotten a clear understanding of. But generally speaking, abuse and dependence. Abuse is generally negative behavior that, or a kind of a compulsive behavior that leads to negative consequences, but there's no physical dependence per se. And then dependence is where people continue this maladaptive behavior to where their brain is wired either genetically or from use, and they experience the physical dependence, the withdrawal. All right. So for some, it can be helpful to understand, you know, that much. Next is what really confuses people or makes it difficult is the labeling, addict, alcoholic. Those labels in general, are counterproductive, generally speaking. And again, check the studies. So people who are labeled addict or alcoholic, many find it difficult to work with those. They tend to negate anything else about the person. The focus is on the negative. And it can become self-fulfilling for many. This is what I am. This is what I do. And that's what can lead to some of the lapse and relapse that people experience. So to me, it's very important to help people understand that they're more than a particular behavior. So the model I use, both the professional treatment, the rationally motive behavior therapy, and the self-help, smart recovery, self-management and recovery training, encourage people not to label themselves, but to understand, you know, the difference between abuse, dependence, and that above anything else, they're multifaceted. They're more than a particular behavior. Give yourself credit where credit's due. Focus on the positive as well as what might be perceived as the negative while you have a sense of self-worth just by the mere fact that you exist. So those are some of the issues that lead to the use. Make it more difficult for people to find help once they decide that they would like it. And I hear this over and over in my office. I mean, hardly a day goes by that I don't hear someone who had experienced professional treatment, 12-step disease model. And some of it just doesn't make sense to them for very practical reasons. And I hear more and more that it's the first time they've heard that there are different ways to view it. Now, to me, that's pretty sad because we have a serious problem out there. And not everybody relates to the same thing. But the predominant model is 12-step disease, and many people don't find it helpful. So we really desperately need some options, and we need people to open their minds to that fact, both professionals and lay people as well. So that's part of my mission, is to try to get this information out. And I'm very, very open to discussing it, and more than happy to talk with people, you know, about it. And again, encouraging them to check it out for themselves ultimately. So I can go
you
on
are,
and on.
You
but,
are saying, you're not saying that you disagree with the 12-step program in general. Just to clarify, it does work for people, and you support those people it does work for.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about it. If someone says it's helping, I say keep doing it. In fact, there are people who kind of work both. I've seen people over the years who came initially because they were having a hard time with some aspect of, say, the 12-step, and they offered them some of this information, and they were able to go back to the 12-step program and get something out of it, understanding that they don't have to accept everything and that there are different ways to view things. So not at all. My goal is to help people ultimately help themselves by whatever means they think is helpful. But they have to be aware of options in order to...
Back to something that you talked about when you were talking about labels and mm-hmm. how people identify themselves with labels.
Yeah.
Now, when you hear the word, addict, alcoholic, something else that is, whatever is used to describe someone that has a habit of some sort, when you hear that, it has this effect in the general public that it creates a stigma. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that there's two ways I think about this that I want you to address is the stigma that it gives an individual who is the habitual user or whatever their issue is it considered an excuse for behavior, number one? And then the second part is, how does that impact society when they hear of such labels?
Well, good question. Some people take it on, and yes, they will use it as an excuse. Keep in mind, it's a serious problem. There's a part of an individual that wants to keep using the alcohol or other drugs or engaging in the related behavior because from a cost-benefit perspective, there's some perceived benefit to it. And like I said, it's a multitude of habits. And habits can be a challenge to change. So yes, some people do use it as an excuse. I'm an addict. I remember a situation. It was a kind of a family gathering. I went down South Carolina for it, and somebody was driving me back to the airport, and they knew what business I was in, and I started talking about their son and who had a problem. And I said, well, yeah, first and foremost, these labels, addict, alcoholic, criminal, they can be self-fulfilling. This is what I am. And the guy looked at me and he said, my God, he says, that's what my son tells me all the time. He says, hey, Pop, what do you expect? I'm an addict, man. I'm a criminal. So to me, that was a very profound example of how some people buy into this to the point where this is what they are, self-fulfilling, which is not very helpful. Other people can work with these labels, use them to their benefit, so to speak. So semantics does play a part. But if you look at studies on labels in general, you're going to find that, generally speaking, they're counterproductive, and especially children. My God, you wouldn't dare label a child, I hope not, as being stupid or no good or bad. That's similar to labeling someone an addict or an alcoholic. Same basic principles apply, and I've seen plenty of examples of that in my experience. This is where the parenting plays into this to such a large degree. One other thing I want to mention that goes along with this labeling is the relapse. The way in which relapse is generally presented in the say treatment field or out there, is it's an inevitable part of this problem. Now, some people hear that and say, well, I guess if it's inevitable, then I'm going to, you know, relapse. Might as well drink or do drugs. Now, it may be conscious or it may be a subconscious. And for some people, this can keep them in that cycle. Now, the fact is, not everybody relapses. Some people say, hey, that's it, I'm done, and they're done. Some individuals do lapse or relapse more time than other individuals. So I ask people, I say, well, what's the magic number? How many relapses do you get here? And then I'll go into explain that it's not inevitable. But if people think it is, that's what that part of the brain could use to keep running, so to speak. Right? So semantics is a huge part of this. And human beings have a way of interpreting things the way they, you know, they want. Not that what I'm saying is magic and it will, you know, help everybody all the time. No, but it can be very helpful to many to understand that there's different ways to this situation. So, again, up to individuals to think about it. Check it out.
Well, let me ask you this one. Since we were talking about lapses and relapsing, what about those who replace one addiction for another?
Yeah, well, that does happen. There's no doubt about it. Like I said, humans spend a lot of time in their lives trying to reach a degree of happiness, however you interpret that, while trying to avoid pain, emotional discomfort. And like I said, people who tend to become to abuse or become dependent on these substances or engage in these other behaviors tends to be symptomatic of some of this discomfort. And they happen to be looking kind of in the wrong place for relief, so to speak. So helping people understand that as well. Now, I've got, you know, a few examples of where people had experienced these emotional issues. And again, it was related to parenting. Two fellows in particular, they were in their 30s at the time. Both came to me about the same time, both with a serious degree of anxiety and some anger, and it was directed toward their parents. Now, one fellow was a very successful business person who had actually become a millionaire, and the other fellow had a couple of master's degrees and taught school, but he was using illicit drugs. Now, the one told me that his parents just wouldn't give him any credit for anything and just kept telling him he wasn't going to amount to anything. So he said when he was young, he started to head toward alcohol and other drugs and then decided, he said he wasn't sure what triggered it, but he had this idea that, you know what, so I'm going to become a millionaire by the time I'm 30 and show them that I'm worth something. And son of a gun, if that's what he didn't do. But he was mistaken. He thought that it was his job that was creating the anxiety he came to me for, when in fact it was he was still angry with his parents because they still wouldn't give him the credit he thought he deserved, even after he became a millionaire. But he turned in a more positive direction. The other guy, same basic thing, his father would not acknowledge that he was really worth much. So the son went about trying to prove it to him. Got two master's degrees, taught school, but his father still wouldn't acknowledge. And then his father went and died on him before he got his father's approval. So he was really pissed, to say the least. What'd he do? He turned to drugs to help him deal with that emotional distress. My point is, we make choices. Some better, some not. There's a lot of misunderstanding out there. People really don't have a good sense of the control they have over their thinking based on the way in which they're nurtured or influenced by even society. There's so much irrationality out there that we just keep perpetuating. So anyway, there's an example of how, you know, we can make different choices.
Well, I really want to start getting into your method and the way you say change your thinking, enhance your life. But at first, mm-hmm. before we do that, I just want to invite our listeners, if they have any thoughts about the controversial things we're saying, any questions, their personal beliefs, give us a call at 646-716-9397. Again, feel free to post something into the chat room or follow us on Twitter at Coach Host Radio, hashtag Gaining Perspective. Just to let you know some of the things that are coming up on the Life Coach Radio Network, tomorrow, October 26th at 12 p.m., I will be hosting Life Coach Chat on the Life Coach Chat channel of Life Coach Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to be discussing discovering your own personal journey. What happens when you wake up one day and all of a sudden realize, this isn't what I really thought I wanted. So starting all over. On Monday, October 28th at 8 p.m., The Spirituality of Justice with your host, Reverend Jennifer Kotler. And on Tuesday, October 29th at 12 p.m. is Fund to Fortune with Entrepreneur Startup Success with Coach Jeff. And the next episode of Gaining Perspective will air on November 14th, and my guest will be Lori Leenwand, founder of Ideas to Actions, and we're going to be talking about making friends with change. She contributed to a book, and so we're going to get some of her ideas of what it is about changing your life. She focuses on parents that have children first going into elementary school, into college, dealing with a half-empty nester or a full-empty nester lifestyle. So that's what we have going on. Again, feel free to give us a call at 646-716-9397. So now that we've talked a lot about labels, about addiction, about how it's in, you have a thought process that people can make the choice of what it is, the symptomatic issues that go on, there's so much, and I want to get into your formula, what it is that you have, that you've started your company and your organization that you found successful. So there are four parts of it that I've seen that you talk about. So can you go through all four, starting with motivation?
Sure. This I've come up with, and this is not something I made up. I mean, I found it here and there, and I simply put it together. This information has been around as long as human beings, it seems. But anyway, motivation, formula for change. If humans decide they'd like to achieve something, you know, whether it's learn something new sport, game, whatever it might be, or gain independence from, say, some maladaptive behavior, such as alcohol or other drug misuse, motivation is important. There has to be some desire there. And the good news is we can enhance our motivation to make these changes. So desire. And then acquiring personally meaningful information. What's helpful to one may not be helpful to someone else. For example, some find the 12 steps helpful, some don't, and some would benefit from something else. So finding that personally meaningful information, whatever it might be, and then applying it with a sense of determination and persistence. The old adage, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And then last is keep it simple to be smart. Now, there's this kiss, keep it simple, stupid is common in the addiction treatment field, and I always found that negative. So I came up with keep it simple, KIS, with a little 2BS. So I suggest people, hey, give yourself a kiss, you know, have some confidence in yourself, have some appreciation for yourself, and go about what you'd like to achieve, keeping in mind that there are some basic principles at work. No need to get yourself overwhelmed and see it as more complex than it might be. So that's the formula for change that I put out there. I can relate to it personally. After looking back on what I had achieved, that's what I did. The self-help model that I subscribe to is called SMART Recovery, Self-Management and Recovery Training. I was a founding board member, and I helped develop the 4 points that it's based on. Now, it's based in part on, well, the cognitive behavior therapy model. especially rational emotive behavior therapy, REBT. I know it gets a little complex here, but you can check these things out online. The basic philosophy is people generally feel and behave the way they think. The one thing we have most control over generally is our thinking. And if people sit down and think about it and are offered some of this information, there are tools and worksheets and things that they can use to help them really understand that this is the case, generally speaking. All right. I didn't go to graduate school until I was about 38 years old. It was about 20-some years ago, or a little longer. And I had gained my independence from alcohol and nicotine and coffee a few years prior to that. And it wasn't until I went to graduate school that I learned about this rational emotive behavior therapy in a theories class. And the minute I read it, I said, my God, that's basically what I did to help myself. It made such sense to me. And that's where I became more involved with the Albert Ellis Institute. Albert Ellis had founded the REBT model. So I eventually went and took their intensive training and became an associate fellow. And I've since done the supervisory training. So I use this model as the basis for my life and my work. It's based on ancient philosophy in part, based on Buddhism, based on common sense. The principles have been around, like I said, as long as human beings, just about. Albert Ellis simply put it into a certain format, which he called the ABC model of personality. It offers a formula that we can actually plug in our emotional and behavioral experiences to get a better understanding of the dynamic and learn to recognize the faultiness of our thinking if, in fact, we're experiencing negative, unhealthy emotions, distress. Learning to recognize that we have choices in how we react to a situation. Some people believe that if something they're subjected to someone or something, they must think, feel, and behave a certain way, which is very unfortunate because that's not true at all. Different people react differently to the same activating event. That's the A in the ABC formula. Any person, place, or thing we experience. Our thinking about that person, place, or thing is what ultimately will determine the consequence, the emotional and or behavioral consequence that we experience, for better or for worse. Not so much based on the activating event, but based on our beliefs about it. Now, this can be hard for some people to grasp. I still sometimes have to really think about it. I mean, life can be quite a challenge. And human beings have this tendency to want things the way they want them, which unfortunately is not always the case, especially when it comes to other people. People are going to act the way they want, not the way we want. So understanding that we have a choice, I'll give you an example of how this model can play out. I use an example where there's four people. One person says something that would be considered disrespectful to these three people. The first person becomes enraged and wants to kill the son of a gun. The second person kind of shrugs it off, walks away, never thinks of it again. And the third person thinks it's funny as can be and starts laughing about it. So you get three different reactions to the same activating event. So if it were the activating event that were causing someone to feel or behave a certain way, well, everybody would feel and behave the same way, but they don't. And that's what happens with these issues such as alcohol and other drugs. People react to various stimulations, activating events, and based on their thinking will feel certain ways and then decide to act certain ways based on their thinking about it. You know, simply, it can get a little bit more complicated than that, but generally speaking, that's the model. So, taking control of the one thing we have most control over, our thinking, understanding the dynamic, understanding that there's different ways to view something, that we do have a choice in the way we feel and behave, generally speaking, despite what might be happening to us or what we're experiencing. So, generally speaking, that's the model.
Yeah, and that's great because, you know, there are a couple of things that you talked about that really just struck up thoughts and experiences in my head that made me think about it and go, oh, wow, you know, that's kind of true. How many times has someone in general who is not habitual ends up saying, oh, my God, what a work week. I just need a drink to just end this week. It's been so tough. And the little things that we say that they immediately think that that's what's going to solve the issue is having a drink to relax, to calm down, or someone who goes into a social setting and they're not the most outgoing person. And what's the first thing other people say to them? Well, have a drink. You'll be okay and you could relax. And I know that we've been using a lot about substance abuse and alcohol abuse. And the thing about it is, there's also where we talk about food addictions is another one. And I know you dabble in that as well. Mm-hmm. But the emotional eater, you know, they're in a relationship that ended badly and all they do is go on a binging spree and then they feel guilty about that and then they purge, the binging and purging, the bulimia and all those other aspects of it. Or I'll even say the exercise fanatic who is so fearful of gaining weight or anything that they're addicted to working out. And to see all this behavior and the thought process that go on, it's how do you help change the negative thinking in there? Because I'm the biggest proponent of if you look at it in a negative way, everything's going to end up in a negative result. Whatever energy you put out is what you're going to get back. So I'm a big proponent on positive thinking. Look for the good aspects of what it is that you're going to go through. Yes, it's been a rough week, but you know what? You made it through. And so what? It's just work. There's bigger things in life that this isn't that big of a deal. What is the great thing that you're looking forward to come out of this? And it's what do you see as the biggest challenge? For me, I see expectations. We set up, and you mentioned it before, where people feel let down, and it's that expectation that we as human beings set for others. And the more you set an expectation for other people's behavior based on the way you would behave, you'll have nothing but disappointment. And then you will end up feeling bad. You know, you're going to have those negative things hit you. How do you, in this experience that you've gone through, whether it be yourself, because that might also be helpful to people, for people to understand is that you've gone through this yourself, letting go of those expectations and not being let down and that being the reason why you have to turn to something else to make you feel good?
Okay. Well, let me play semantics here. Instead of expectations, the beliefs, the difference between a desire and a demand. There's a tendency for humans to not only expect but to demand that people, places, things be the way they think they should be. We set ourselves up for some serious emotional distress if we hold and reinforce beliefs like that. Because the reality is people are going to act the way they want, not the way we want. That is unconditional acceptance of reality. That's going to leave someone in a much more comfortable, stable, emotional state. Having a desire, gee, I really wish they would, or it'd be nice if they did this or didn't do that, but hey, if they don't, let me see how I can best deal with that. Unconditional acceptance of reality versus unrealistic demand is so fundamental to emotional stress. That alone can help people really enhance the way they feel and behave, generally speaking. First, understanding that and then applying it to various experiences they have in life. And again, personally meaningful information, motivation, practice. Practice, practice, practice. Put it to work for yourself. It can take some time and some effort. Some catch on more quickly, just like anything else. But that is so fundamental to this issue. There is a lot of anger out there, a lot of anxiety, a lot of distress. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal recently that I said that studies are showing that more people are more distressed now than ever before. The misuse of alcohol, other drugs is on the rise, despite all of the efforts to try to curtail it. People are looking for relief from this distress that they're ultimately, for the most part, creating themselves through their faulty thinking. Now, just to give a sense, it's not saying you should never feel upset. That'd be kind of tough, given human nature. But you have a choice between what's referred to as negative, unhealthy emotions based on this faulty, irrational, demandingness, for example, anxiety, anger, depression, guilt, shame, as compared to negative, healthy emotion, instead of anger, frustration, or annoyance, for example, based on reasonable thinking. For example, instead of feeling angry based on your unrealistic demand, exchanging that for a more realistic view, unconditional acceptance of reality, you'd be in a heck of a lot different place. And again, these emotions can be experienced in degrees, from severe to mild. But this fundamental change in thinking can bring you up a notch. And then there's always the positive emotions, happiness, contentment. Now, here's another one that people aren't really necessarily aware of. When people talk about stress, they generally mean the distress, the negative, the uncomfortable stuff, stressed out. When in fact, stress in and of itself could be either negative, or eustress, beneficial. And the difference is in the thinking. People can experience, like I said, the same activating event and have a completely different a reaction to it, from the negative, unhealthy to the eustress, the beneficial. EU in front of a word means beneficial. For example, I use a sports example. You know, people are out on a field or a court, and three people go out to play, and one is saying things like, "My God, if I go out there and screw up, my teammates are going to kick my butt, and boy, I'd feel like a real idiot." And they're getting themselves distressed, experiencing some high anxiety, for example. Odds are they're not going to be able to perform the way they would otherwise be able to, because they're so distracted by the distress. Next person goes out, and they're just out to have a good time. I'm just going to go out and enjoy myself. And they're kind of in the middle somewhere, you know, more relaxed than anything. Third person goes out, and they're saying things like, "Gee, I'm going to really give my all. I love this game. I'm going to play to my max." And they got themselves pumped up, okay? They're experiencing eustress. Their body's under stress. They might be perspiring, breathing heavy, but it's in a positive vein. They're going to be most likely focused and able to play to their ability. So those two, the desire or preference versus the unrealistic demand, and knowing the difference between distress and eustress, can be very, very helpful to people to make that change. Now, I think I had given you one of those little yellow cards from the Albert Ellis Institute.
I actually have it sitting right in front of me, because I was just literally going to bring it up and talk about them. Yes.
Good. All right. Well, you can talk about it. This is what I'm referring to basically, is some of the fundamental beliefs that people hold that can create the distress, leaving them looking for relief.
Well, excellent. So let's start with the ones of the ideas to make you disturbed. Share with our audience about love slobism.
Yes, love slobism was a term coined by Albert Ellis, the founder of REBT, and I don't have a copy in front of me.
Okay, so I'll read it
We must be loved and approved by practically every significant person, otherwise it's terrible. Some people get it in their head. I mean, we're social beings. We're looking for acceptance, and it's very nice to get that. But unfortunately, given human nature, the reality is it would be nice to be loved and approved by practically every significant person, but even if we aren't, we can still love and approve of ourselves. Again, that's the unconditional acceptance of reality. On the one hand, yeah, it would be great to be approved by every significant person, but reality suggests that that's not going to happen. Somewhere along the line, we're not going to be appreciated the way we think we should be, which is going to leave us feeling probably angry, depressed, anxious, whatever it might be. So again,
the other two that are on here, you've already touched on it basically with the sports analogy you just gave, the perfectionism, and with, you know, I must not make errors or do poorly, and if I do, it's terrible.
Right. So, now, see, these. Let me go over some of the key terms just so people understand. The shoulds and the musts are generally unrealistic demands. The no law of nature says that we should be treated any particular way. Okay, if we demand that, chances are we're gonna experience some discomfort emotionally, some anger, for example. All right, then you have the shoulds, musts, have tos, the can'ts, the always, the nevers. I must never make mistakes. That would be nice, but we're fallible. Humans tend to make mistakes. But if you use those categorical terms, those absolutistic terms, chances are you're going to fall short somewhere and experience that. And then you have the have to, can'ts, always, nevers. My mind's drawing a blank. I have that memorized, but I can't quite get to it. You have the have tos and the can'ts, the horrible, terrible, awfuls. Those are defined as worse than 100% bad. Nothing can be worse than 100% bad. So we set ourselves up again. And in doing this work, doing what they call an ABC, having people complete this worksheet, coming up with the beliefs they hold, odds are if they're feeling some distress or behaving in ways that aren't in their best interest, they're going to be thinking some of these very thoughts. Those are the common irrational beliefs that people hold. Some may be subconscious, some may be right in the forefront of the mind. What we tend to do is we learn our thinking patterns from when we're young, we reinforce them for better or for worse until they just seem to be. Some people say, well, I didn't think about it, I just did it. Well, no, you thought about it, there was a chain of thinking there, but it's been so reinforced, you know, you weren't really conscious of it. So then you have the last one I went over, the low frustration tolerance. People in events should always be the way I want them to be.
Right. Well, as we're closing up, let's get into the ideas to help you function effectively. So the self-acceptance, fallibility, and realism. So talk about that, and then we're going to have to wrap up our show.
Oh, okay. How to function effectively. All right. Certainly having an idea of how you would like to function. Like I said, most people spend a good part of their time in pursuit of what's referred to as happiness, however you define it. So having a better sense and understanding of what that is exactly and where it comes from. Many people think happiness comes from without. Well, in reality, it comes from within. And nothing says that we should have to gotta be happy, although some people have this demand. So to function effectively, have an idea of how it is you would prefer to function. If you're not functioning that way, look at your thinking. What are you saying to yourself with regards to, say, a specific aspect of your functioning, for example? And odds are you're going to find some of this faulty thinking. Now, what was it you said, function effectively, and what was the next one?
It was the self-acceptance, fallibility, and realism.
Okay. Self-acceptance, that's a big issue. This whole self-esteem model that's been put on our children over the years in schools and that has been shown by study to be basically worthless. It's made children worse off, helped them for this reason. This whole notion of self-esteem, in order to feel good about myself, I must achieve and do well. Well, first of all, we're multifaceted. We're not one behavior, but people have been led to believe that in order to you have to have self-esteem. You have to, if you fall short somewhere, you can't feel good about yourself. that negates anything else about the person. That's where these labels are so detrimental to many people. Right? They put their whole sense of worth into one event, and it's going to leave them feeling much worse than they would otherwise. So this model suggests self having a sense of self-worth just by the mere fact that you exist, and then take individual characteristics and behaviors and characterize them as good, bad, indifferent. While you maintain this sense of self-worth, you're going to be in a much better place emotionally, and you're going to have a clearer picture of where you are functioning more the way you would like, and maybe not so in other places, and give you an opportunity to, you know, understand your positive characteristics, using that to help you maybe enhance in some other area. Again, fundamental to emotional stability and appropriate behavior. Now, something else you had asked.
No, what I want to do is we only have a couple of minutes left.
Okay.
So I want you to share with our audience any closing thoughts that you have, and also how they could reach your website or get in touch with you if they want to see what it's like to go through your program that you have.
Okay. First and foremost, I would encourage people to check out what I'm saying. You can go to my website, thethoughtexchange.biz, B-I-Z, smartrecovery.org, thealbertellis.org website, and keep in mind, your ability to think and reason is potentially your greatest resource. I would encourage you to consider that, and that there are choices and options, and not everybody relates to one. And if you have any questions, by all means, contact me. I'm more than happy to speak to you, free phone consultation, half hour or so. And if you have any concerns about some things I said or criticisms, by all means, get in touch with me. I'm more than happy to discuss. And I'd just like to say I really appreciate this opportunity, and Andrea for what she's doing, and I'll look forward to listening to some of her future shows.
Great. Well, thank you, Rich. I really appreciate you being on here and helping me tackle a topic that I never really thought that I'd be addressing, but as I see how effective this topic is for the people I care about, those that they're surrounded by, and even my audience and business clients that have these issues to deal with on a regular basis in the workplace or in their life, I felt that this was something for me to grow and learn about, and I really appreciate you joining me and giving that opportunity for myself. For the audience members, believe me, there was nothing I meant to do by offend anyone. I just wanted to really see what it was like to cover a tough topic and maybe even clarify some of the myths that were in my head or what society has taught me to believe. And maybe some of you out there have thought the same thing and wanted clarification on it. Again, if you're out there and you want to know a different way of addressing some of your concerns, reach out to the Thought Exchange. Give them a call, check out their website, and Rich will be gladly able to help you and listen to you. So for my closing thoughts, it's very true. You know, choices are one thing that we have in life, but when it comes to something that we feel that is out of our control, that we don't have anything on, reach out to someone you love. Reach out for help, because there are so many people that will be there for you. And it may not be a friend or family member. It could actually be a total stranger that is going to be your closest ally. So I'd just like to say in closing, thank you all for listening today. I hope no matter what, you enjoyed this past hour, found it engaging, enlightening, and now focused on a path to getting to where you want to be in life. If you have any thoughts, suggestions, or ideas that you'd like to see on Gaining Perspectives, please reach out to us on thelifecoachradionetworks.com. Thank you very much, and I hope everybody enjoys the rest of the day. Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.